Welcome to the Open Book Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger, and this is episode number 2. This is my second episode, and I've done this last one with Katie Moore, publicist of Image Books. Today, I'm real pleased to have a different scenario. We're recording on-site, no Skype. And I'm thrilled to have as my guest an award-winning author of more than 40 books on Catholic history, doctrine, and devotion. He's hosted 9 television series and several documentary films, and is a frequent guest on Catholic radio. He's been a tremendous support to me and mentor these past 2 years at the Catholic Book Blogger, my dear friend Mike Aquilino. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here. It's good to be in New Oxford, and I'm kind of intimidated. I have to follow Katie. I've been working with her a long time. I'm used to her telling me what to do, and now I've got to follow after her. Goodness.
I'm sure you'll be fine. I'm the one who should be nervous here. Okay, just want to talk a little bit about books, of course. And to be honest, Mike, when I want to do any research on the Church Fathers, and I know more than just myself, others go and grab one of your books. You've kind of become known as, authority on the Church Fathers. Some of my favorite ones that you've written were Faith of Our Fathers, While the Early Church Still Matters and Always Will, and The Fathers of the Church, An Introduction to the First Christian Teachers, which is now in its 3rd edition, and A Year with the Church Fathers, Patristic Wisdom for Daily Living, published by St. Benedict Press. And with your permission and St. Benedict Press, I've been featuring daily excerpts from that on the blog, which has been a pretty positive response to that. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of the, as I said, more than 40 books you've written. But basically, what started your interest in the Church Fathers?
Well, my interest began a long time ago. I guess I've always been interested in ancient things. When I was a little boy, I wanted to be an archaeologist because it seemed like a great adventure. You know, I read about Schliemann finding Troy, you know, digging down until he found it because he was convinced it must be there. And so it was a story of adventure when you read it that way. And of course, I grew up in the 1960s and 70s watching all the old sword and sandal epics. So there were certain images of how the ancient world looked and what it's like to discover it, kind of a great adventure. So I've always been tuned in that way. My favorite classes during college were history classes. So I've been interested in history. As I began to take my faith more seriously when I was in my 20s, I wanted to read the classic texts. I got into the scriptures, and I got into the earliest Christian voices, the apostolic fathers, and then later fathers of the church. I guess in terms of academic study, the thing that really got me going was the appearance of a book in the early 1980s called The Gnostic Gospels by Elaine Pagels, and it was quite the rage at the time. Okay. And one of my professors at Penn State was very excited about it, and he asked me if I would do an independent study on it. And it was that independent study that got me reading Irenaeus of Lyon and other church fathers who opposed the Gnostics. So I did my independent study on Gnosticism and the church's response and kept it going from there. Now, it was a long time after that our Sunday visitor asked me to do a book on the church fathers. But that's because they saw a need in the market, and Bob Lockwood, who was then publisher of Our Sunday Visitor, knew about my interest in the Church Fathers.
And when you put one of these books together, let's use the Fathers of the Church and the A Year with the Church Fathers as an example. How much research goes into putting these books together? In particular, the Year with the Church Fathers, you're coming up with a daily excerpt for each day. So you must have a massive resource library that you're going to be able to compile that.
Well, I do have a massive library. I've been fortunate in that. I've had some good friends who were patristic scholars and much older than I am, and when they died, they left me their libraries. So I'm surrounded by books, and they're good books, and they're even well marked up by these great scholars whom I've known. I do have that at my disposal. In terms of research, I guess it varies depending on the book. some of the books that are more specialized, like Signs and Mysteries, which is about ancient Christian art, well, that required me to do a lot of reading in archaeology and a lot of reading in secondary sources, scholarship on Christian art in particular. But for a lot of the other books, like you mentioned, A Year with the Church Fathers and The Fathers of the Church, a lot of it is just drawn from what I've already read, you know, and it's all there somewhere in my brain, and I just have to scratch my noggin a little bit to shake it loose. And when I do, the books are there in my library at my disposal.
So just curious, and listeners might be curious as well, out of the books you've written, how many of them are by your own inclination to write it, or are you being asked to write?
You know, almost all of my books I've written at the invitation of my publishers. They've wanted a book on a certain topic, and they've identified me as the person to write it. Almost all of them. There are some exceptions. The Mass of the Early Christians was my idea. Signs and Mysteries was my idea. My book on the Apostle Thomas, The Doubter's Novena, was my idea. The Grail Code was my idea. So there are a handful of books that have been done on my initiative, but most of them have come through the invitation of my publishers. And I have wonderful publishers. They come up with great ideas that get me excited about doing these projects.
Yeah, which that is to be noted. You don't have one house you stay with. Your Image, our Sunday Visitor, St. Benedict Press, kind of have run the gambit with who you publish with.
Well, what I find is that the different publishers often have different markets.
Mm, okay.
And so you're reaching a different audience each time. And since I'm interested in these particular topics, you know, it enables me to get the word out to a different crowd with each new book.
Okay. One other series I'd like to talk about is what I've deemed the trilogy, for a good reason. Your work with His Eminence Cardinal Donald Worrell. The book, first book in the trilogy was The Mass, the Glory, the Mystery, and the Tradition. The second, The Church, Unlocking the Secrets to the Places Catholics Call Home. And the third, The Feasts, How the Church Year Forms Us as Catholics, which made my top 10 picks list for 2014. How did this idea formulate for this? Was it always meant to be a trilogy? Or did it kind of come about that way?
Well, it wasn't from the beginning, but from fairly early on. It started with Gary Jansen at Image Books. Gary approached me and Cardinal Worrell together and asked if we would be willing to collaborate. He knew that we were old friends, that we go back a long way, and he thought it would be interesting if we collaborated on a book about the Mass. The most fundamental thing in a Catholic's life. You know, it's the place where we go and the scriptures are proclaimed and we receive the body and blood of Jesus Christ. You know, when we look at the early church, you know, we see in the Acts of the Apostles, what did the early Christians do? Well, they met for the teaching of the apostles and the communion, the breaking of the bread and the prayers. That's what we see in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, verse 42. And it's what the church did. And Cardinal Worrell, who has a very meat and potatoes approach to the faith, likes to say, very simply, in a beautiful phrase, which I love, the Mass is what we do. It's what we do as Catholics.
It is, truly, you know, is.
In a sense, it's God's action, but God has called us to participate in this action, this divine action, which is the Mass. You know, it's one of the great consequences of the Incarnation, that we share the life of Jesus Christ. St. Peter said we become partakers of the divine nature, and this is the ordinary way we do it. And we do it through ordinary means, you know, through bread and wine. You know, it's a beautiful thing that we have, and it can be part of our everyday life. It's at least part of our weekly life.
Right.
You know, a church can have a great social program. A church can be running a soup kitchen. A church can have a wonderful parish festival every year that raises a lot of money. A church can sponsor bingo every week, and all those things are nice. But the Mass is what the church does. That's what it's all about. It's the most important thing in any parish's life. And every Catholic knows that instinctively. And so Gary wanted us to do a book about that basic reality and just unpacking it slowly. you know, talking about the vestments the priest wears, the vessels he uses, the prayers and the responses that we do in the Mass, and then walking through the parts of the Mass very carefully, methodically, and explaining each one, explaining its history, explaining the scriptural roots of that particular place in the Mass, and its symbolism, what it means.
Yeah, so then you build upon that with the second book, The Church.
Mm-hmm.
The home for where the Mass is held.
Yeah,
which was a good read too. I mean, you obviously get good feedback from people who've read it before. Francis Cardinal George says people baptized and alive in Christ or His Church. They gather in buildings called churches. This well thought out and beautifully presented book tells everyone what our churches are about and why they contain what they do. I hope it finds a prominent place in RCI presentations, in religious education programs, or family bookshelves. And that was one thing that when I did the review for the feast, I pointed out was this package of three books, to me, is a good jumping-off point for anyone new coming into the faith or anyone that has departed and wants to come back. It builds a good foundation of what, as you said, the Mass is about, what the building we're celebrating in is about, and then you move on to the third book and talk about the celebrations, the feasts.
Yeah. Well, the way the Cardinal puts it is, the Mass is what we do, the Church is where we do it, and the feasts are when we do it.
And that's true. And the feast just released this year. Again, it made my top 10 picks for 2014. There's a couple reasons that I'll explain to listeners how I get about to those 10 picks. Obviously, I read basically a book a week, which people ask me how I do that. So I spend my time reading. We don't watch much TV. We do some, but so my time spent reading. What spare time I have, lunch breaks at work, I'm reading, writing. But there's three things I usually look at for books to make that list. One, does it hook me? Does it get me to the point where I'm reading it and I can't put it down? Two, is it providing information that helps me grow spiritually and that I think will help others grow spiritually? And three, just the delivery of the book, how it's written, and again, will it help others in their faith? And this book did meet that criteria for me as well as the other nine. But the whole trilogy to me does. I mean, like I said, this is something that to me, RCI students should be required to read.
Well, thank you.
So let's move on to some stuff that's new. Now, the current one I'm reading right now is The Ancient Path, Old Lessons from the Church Fathers for a New Life Today by John Michael Talbot with Mike Aquilina. So how did this partnership come about?
Well, I've known John for a long time. One of my neighbors in my town was a member of his community, and when she was dying, she had a cancer that metastasized, and when she was dying, we were kind of pitching in to help take care of her. And what impressed me was that John, who was one of the busiest people I knew, dropped everything and came to take care of her. I've always felt indebted to him for doing that, and so I looked forward to a time when we could work together. When I was editing New Covenant magazine, a magazine of Catholic spirituality, which I edited for about 6 years. And when I was editing New Covenant, John wrote for me a little bit, and we'd stayed in touch down the years. So a few years ago, I was leading the retreat for his community at Little Portion Monastery in Arkansas, and John and I got to spend some time talking. And at a certain point, he said, "Wow, we should record these conversations." And so we turned on our recorder, and we got a lot of conversation down over the course of the week, because I was giving two conferences a day, and then John and I would spend the entire afternoon talking about the Church Fathers. And it's an interest we share, and so we got excited, and John said, "Wouldn't it be neat if we could turn these recordings into a book?" And so we did. We turned those recordings into a book. It's called The Ancient Path now, and it's out for from Image Books. Again, I give a lot of credit to my editor. Gary Jansen is someone who can hear an idea like that and take it and refine it and make it into something really wonderful. So I think he did it with that book. I really like that book.
Yeah, and you know, to bring something out again, and I point this out sometimes as well, everything to me comes back to the early church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk about the new evangelization, but we're not really doing anything that hasn't been done before.
That's right, that's right.
You bring it up in the book, Faith of Our Fathers. This was what the first book of yours I read 2 years ago. But you bring up, you know, people complain about, you know, their lives today and what they're going through. But mm-hmm. to me, you don't know what a struggle is until you're facing down a line in an arena. I mean, yeah. These guys, the early Christians, you know, you have people saying about religious freedom in our country today. And, yeah, it might be getting tread on a little bit, but you're not getting hung at a stake, used mm-hmm. for a light.
Right.
And the things that they went through, it's to read what the early Christians went through and still kept their faith and grew the faith at mm-hmm. the astounding rate they did is amazing to me.
Yeah, 40% per decade, sustained over more than two centuries. It was explosive growth.
Right. And one of the things you bring up in that book is how it happened. And when you were here in New Oxford to do our retreat 2 summers ago, that was one of the talks, was how the early Christians grew the faith through caring for each other, for loving their neighbor, which was not something the Roman Empire had been seeing at that time because of how the Roman authorities were.
And not only the authorities, but the family. The family was breaking down, and once the family begins to break down, it's hard to sustain any kind of loving care. You know, you don't have a place to go home to. You don't have a place where you feel welcome. You don't have a place where you are so important. So, you know, what happened was Christianity arose in that world really. Sustained good families and good homes, and people looked at those families and they said, I want to be like that. I want to have what they have. I want to be happy that way. And Christians showed them a way to be happy by caring for others, by giving their lives in service. You know, you talked about the martyrs, and they're a great example to us and a great ideal for us, really. But relatively few of the early Christians died as martyrs. You know, they were exceptional in a sense. Most of the early Christians, though, lived with that risk, but in the midst of that risk, they still lived sacrificial lives. What they had, they gave, and they gave in love. They took care of their neighbors. They took care of the people on their street, and gradually the people on their street said, whatever it is that you have, I don't care what the risk is, I want it. You have something you're living for, and I don't have anything to live for. You know, suicide was epidemic in the Roman Empire. Euthanasia was very common. Infanticide was very common. Contraception was widespread. All of these things that the church says today destroys love and produces a culture of death. Well, all of those things were active in the Roman Empire, and they were fulfilling that. You know, mm-hmm. They were really creating a culture of death and sustaining it and making it worse as the years went on. And the people could see that all around them. But so many of the people, and so especially the leaders, would not accept a different way. They could not even imagine a different way because they were so mired in their sins.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring it up, we're seeing some of that today.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, history does repeat itself.
Well, it does, and what we have to believe is that history can repeat itself in terms of the conversion that follows.
Yes,
you know that the people who are living this way, they might claim to be happy because they're indulging pleasures, but they're really making their lives miserable and more miserable the longer they just indulge their pleasures, indulge their whims, and indulge their selfishness. They make themselves self-centered, and it makes for a miserable life because that's a loveless life. As they get older, they come to realize that, but often by then it's too late. It's too late for them, or at least they feel that way, because they're no longer going to experience the pleasures they did when they were young, and they're no longer going to find it easy to find the companionship and that sort of thing. What Christianity does is it shows us how to train ourselves in self-giving from the very beginning, to die to self, you know, so that when we finally get to our death, our physical death, it's not so much of a surprise. We've been preparing for that moment through a long life. And no matter how many years of suffering even precede that death, we're prepared for it because of what Jesus Christ has done for us, but also because of the life he's given us through the sacraments and through the life of the church.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get a little off track here because something you said there sparked something, a thought.
There is no track, so...
You know, 2 years ago before I started this blog, I was very lukewarm in my faith. I attended Mass out of a sense of obligation because we had young children, mm-hmm. and it was the right thing to do. What changed for me was the book Be a Man by Father Larry Richards. Mm. I read that book. When you open a book and the first words of the book are, "Gentlemen, you are going to die." Yeah. And you're reading that at 38, yeah. you know, you're yeah. on top of the world, young, yeah. thinking it, you know, not that's the remotest thing from my mind, but you read that, and then the rest of the book's like, boom. Mm-hmm. And I had the pleasure of attending a retreat with him in Lancaster locally. That was a day-long retreat. Followed this following summer, which would have been the summer of 2013, a weekend men's conference or retreat at Mount St. Mary's. So it kind of kept building on itself. To you know where I am today, and had it not been for that book, I would have never met you. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be sitting here talking today. The blog wouldn't be what it was.
Yeah.
But again, it takes that realization for a person to be able to act upon their faith, to have that eye-opening experience. I think to understand.
Yeah.
You know, there is more. Than what we have here in this secular world.
Yeah. Now, if people were really as happy as they claim to be when they're indulging pleasures, we would not be dealing with so many of the things that we have to deal with today. Things like road rage, you know, yeah. and all of these other miseries that we see around us. We have to help people to name the unease they have. We have to help them to recognize it because the world isn't going to give them that vocabulary.
Right.
So we have to do it because we have it revealed to us in the Holy Scriptures. We have it revealed to us in the life of the church. So we have something that can make sense of their lives, that can help them to find happiness. And if we keep that to ourselves, it's kind of like hiding antibiotics during an epidemic. You know, we'll be held responsible for that, for hoarding it in our homes rather than, you know, giving it out to the people we know, people who are so unhappy.
And as Catholics, I think that our faith has the keys to that. We have the Mass, as you said. Mm-hmm. We have the outlet of confession that others don't. And it's just a matter of, as part of the new evangelization, educating people on that.
Yeah. The parable of the talents should be sobering for us. I mean, because our Lord will hold us accountable for what he's given us. There's a great quote that's often attributed to St. Ambrose of Milan. We'll be held accountable not only for every idle word, but for every idle silence.
Yeah, that's pretty strong. Mm. But it's sobering, and mm-hmm. We need to do something about that. Mm-hmm. One more book I'd like to talk about. This is not due out till February. Mm-hmm. One of the great things about being a book reviewer is I get these nice little galley copies before they're even in the public hands. This one is Seven Revolutions, How Christianity Changed the World and Can Change It Again. I briefly browsed through this book, so I'm as new to this as anybody listening to this. So can you tell us a little bit about this book?
Well, that book is a collaboration with my friend Jim Papandrea, who's a professor of church history at Garrett Theological Seminary in Chicago. And Jim, as I said, is a dear friend. He's a great scholar a great scholar of the 3rd century, and he himself has written many books on the Church Fathers. So Jim and I have been doing conferences together. We've been talking together for a long time. He's also a recent convert to the faith. He teaches at Garrett, which is an evangelical seminary. He teaches patristics. He also leads pilgrimages to Rome. So we've been talking about doing this because we find that we have a similar approach to study of that period, that we look at the power Christianity had to transform a culture. So in the book Seven Revolutions, we look at a number of ways that Christianity did transform the Roman Empire. You know, transformed the idea of the family and the way family life was lived out, you know, in the neighborhoods. It transformed the way we look at women. It made possible women's rights. It transformed the way we view the human person. These ideas that we have today that we take for granted, we think that they are just ideas that are kind of evident in nature, but they're not. You know, like what? The idea of human nature, human dignity, human equality, equality between the sexes. All of these are ideas that have not played well in paganism. They haven't even arisen in paganism. Right. You know, it took Christianity to introduce these ideas into the Greco-Roman world, and those ideas went on to transform that world and make it a more charitable place.
Indeed. Actually, I showed this yesterday to my spiritual director, and he immediately went to chapter 10, a Christian's to-do list for the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually intrigued him, and I'm supposed to report back to him what I get out of that. How did you develop that chapter? I mean, like I said, I briefly looked at this, and you're giving kind of a roadmap for life today, really.
Well, I have to take full credit for that, really. And I'll tell you, the way I did that was by choosing to work with a genius for a co-author. Jim Papandrea wrote that chapter, and Jim is a very bright guy who has a vision for not only how we lived life in the 3rd century, but how we might learn from that life and live it again today. Jim wrote that chapter, which is prescriptive, and which draws a lot of lessons from that period, and I'm indebted to him for that.
Very good. So, everybody, again, this one is due out in February of 2015 by Image Books. So now, one thing I talk about a lot is the books that influence me. What books influence Mike Aquilina?
Wow, a lot of them. I talked about the books I read when I was a little kid, books about archaeology and books about ancient history. And they excited my imagination. In terms of the books we've discussed today, I've actually been deeply influenced by a book by a sociologist named Rodney Stark. He's an agnostic. He did a study of the church during the first 3 centuries. It's called The Rise of Christianity. And that book shook me. You know, it came out in the 90s. I had already been writing about this period. But the way he looked at it kind of turned the whole period on its head for me. Because if you read the church histories, whether the ancient church histories or the modern ones, they tend to focus on the life of the clergy. Because the clergy are the public members of the church. And they're the ones whose names get in the paper, so to speak.
Right.
And that was true in the ancient world as well. But what Stark points out is that the clergy during the time of persecution were fairly disposable. They had a bullseye painted on them, and you know they went down pretty easy once the persecutions kicked in. It was ordinary families that transformed the Roman world. It was ordinary families that evangelized the Roman world, and they made possible this rapid conversion rate. And it's from him that I got that statistic of 40% per decade, sustained over more than 2 centuries. So that book had a profound influence on me. After that, I've been really influenced by the work of Robert Louis Wilkin, an American church historian and a convert to the faith, and also Jean Danielou, Cardinal Jean Danielou, who was a French historian and theologian of of the middle part of the last century. He's influenced me a lot. Oh, I don't know, Pete. You ask a dangerous question when you ask about the books that influence me, because my mind starts to race down the bookshelves that are behind me all day, every day, and there are so many of them.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the point I'm getting at. There's a lot of books, a lot of books coming in.
Yeah, we shouldn't lose the habit of reading them because books can take us deep and. I love the fact that we're living and working in a time when we can reach a lot of people through podcasts, through radio on the web, satellite, television, you know. And I've taken advantage of all of these media, and I've tried to make the most of my opportunities in these media. But nothing is like a book for taking us deeply into a subject, exciting our imagination. Giving us an imaginative entry into a world we never knew and maybe can never know, mm-hmm. and really exciting us to live a different sort of life, allowing us to push back and contemplate things.
One last question. Are there any current projects you're working on you'd like to share?
Got a lot of things going. let me think. The most immediate one is I want to finish up a book that's going to be a companion volume to the NBC miniseries AD, which will air during Easter week in 2015. So I'll write the book that will be the companion volume to that series. It'll take us through the apostolic era and into the era of the apostolic fathers.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
My other big project I'm working on now is my friend Dion DiMucci, who's a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, is working on an album with Jimmy Vivino, and I wrote most of the music for that album with Dion, and so it's a different
outlet.
Yeah, for me, and I've never experienced this before. I was never wrote songs until Dion kind of dragged me into it, and so I'm experiencing it now as we're getting the recordings back from the studio.
Yeah. And something some people may not know about you is you also write poetry.
I do. I had a book come out last year, a collection called Terms and Conditions. And I've been, I studied actually at Penn State, and I've been writing poetry since then. So yeah, that's another thing for me.
Excellent. Well, Mike, it has been an absolute pleasure as always to spend some time with you today. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Pete. It's great to be here with you.
Yes, as always, like I said. So, ladies and gentlemen, until next time, open a book, keep reading, build your faith, and go evangelize. God bless.
Take me where you are, I miss myself.